daunting for guys unaccustomed to working out. It takes time, energy, and dedication, all commensurate with how out of shape that guy is to begin with. There are countless Chubby Chaser websites dedicated to catering to this particular fetish for men, but not a single one exists for women. Why? By that, I mean there is a percentage in society of otherwise average, fit men seeking out obese women. Yet the standard for ideal masculinity seems to remain constant for females by the lack of fetishes for obese males. There is such a demand in society by men seeking fat women that businesses have been developed in order to meet it. But there is no similar demand on the part of fit women, or one not sufficient enough to register, seeking overweight men. Why do you suppose this is? There has never been a Rubenesque period for men, where overweight men were considered the feminine ideal in history. A muscular, athletic build has always been the masculine standard. Men define what is feminine and sexy for women. However, the inverse is true in that women define what is masculine and sexy for men. The reason women find particular aspects of men's physiology sexually arousing is because the men in the past who embodied them were rewarded with sex often enough to make those traits psychological subroutines in women's brains. Yes, game is vitally important, as is root-level dynamic personal change. I don't think I need to explain just how important this is. However, looks count. Looks matter. What I find amazingly ironic is that looks are one of the few areas of change that a man has direct control over, his body. Barring physical disabilities, you have no excuse not to be in better shape. Why wouldn't you want the full package? Stop being so goddamn lazy and accept you'll need to exert some effort and sweat to make yourself more attractive and more arousing to women. Game and a positive masculine mindset are vital elements for your attractiveness and well-being, but they won't make you look any better with your shirt off. Side note. I should also point out that for as much as women will assert that a man's penis size is irrelevant to their sexual pleasure, often the first insult they'll hurl at a man in order to shame him is, "I'll bet he's got a small dick." You connect the dots. The myth of feminine SMV. The manosphere has been awash in articles detailing the sexual marketplace, including my own, and the impact women's short-term versus long-term sexual strategies have for them for as long as I've been writing about gender issues, 10-plus years. These analyses range from the biological consequences to the insidious, life-damaging punishment a socialized feminine primacy, feminism, inflicts upon unassuming members of both sexes. Their most recent manifestations of this have been the social shaming efforts of the Man Up 2.0 popularizations in mainstream media. Yes, I'm guilty of cracking this topic more than once, but it bears repeating how feminism, equalism, and the feminine imperative conspire to reinvent sexual market value for women. SMV. In navigating the SMV, I graphed out my own rudimentary overview of how the SMP lays out, as well as sexual market values relative to each sex. Although I began a bit tongue-in-cheek, in all earnestness, I attempted to visually plot out what a person's life timeline might look like were he or she to have a God's eye perspective of when their SMV will be at its apogee, when it builds and when it wanes. As with everything I put to keyboard, my effort was to get to the honest nuts and bolts of the SMP and how our lives' events coincide with that valuation. Here's the breakdown again. This was an effort in defining a contemporary, realistic view of how sexual market value fluctuates for each sex. I think it's comparatively reflective, if a bit rough. However, I approach this graph from a male perspective, in that its intent was to educate men of their SMV potential later in life and to plan accordingly. What I didn't account for is feminization's influence on women's, and by association men's, collective understanding of their own SMV. Given the plenitude of Manosphere articles devoted to women's distorted and diluted interpretations of their sexual market value, I figured this had been done to death. It took a bit of digestion to shake a new thought into my head. Women like men. As if on cue, Team Red vents his frustration from a comment thread. Why should money even matter anymore to these women in the long term when it seems like the majority of them have put their careers first and put marriage and kids off until later in life? It seems like the dating world is polluted with 30-plus-year-old career women that have been riding the carousel 10 to 15 years and are now ready to settle down and pop out 2 to 3 kids by the ripe old age of 40. What these women seem to have forgotten is the greater risk involved having children so late in life. I found this comment apropos since it sums up my thoughts on the myth of the biological clock. Women want to be men. This is the legacy that a since-decayed feminist social impetus has imparted to the generations of both men and women who've come after the glorious Steinems got married themselves, dried up, and blew away. Women need to be the men of tomorrow. I suppose I should have seen this messaging before, and in honesty, I think the greater part of feminized thinking revolves around role reversal. But this is more than reversal. Women want to be men. If a man can wait until his maturation develops, his achievements are more actualized, and his SMV peaks at 38 to 40. Equalism says, why shouldn't you man, girl? Whether it's in terms of dom versus sub in sexually fluid relationships, or in terms of respect or social entitlement, women want to be men. This is what 60-plus years of feminization has taught women is valuable, and taught men to accommodate for. In fact, men are lesser men for not offering women a hand up to manhood. Feminization in this respect is the ultimate form of penis envy. A culture at consecutive generations of both sexes willing to masculinize women into prominence. This is the heart of the feminine imperative and feminine primacy. Hypergamy and women's innate psychologies naturally conflict with this socialization effort. Thus, we have women expecting masculine equability while simultaneously feeling entitled to traditionally feminine courtesies and expectations. This is what having it all means. In the interest of feminine primacy, if it works, use it. So it should come as no shock that in a desire to be like men, a popularized parallel had to be socialized into women's collective understanding of SMV expectations. In the most literal sense, if men could enjoy a more progressive and maturing SMV then, by the doctrines of equalism, a new woman should also be able to mirror that masculine SMV. Feminized SMV. By a combined effort of feminism, feminine primacy, and its imperatives, women have been socialized and acculturated to believe that their SMV profile encompasses and is synchronous with that of men. Since women are essentially men, equalism, the religion of feminism, convinces women that their SMV schedule should at least be identical to that of men. I could have simply recolored the men bell curve from my previous SMV graph to illustrate the feminized redefinition of SMV, but that would be inaccurate. It wouldn't account for the obvious benefits women expect to enjoy in their true sexual peak years, 22 to 24. In addition to the masculinized SMV feminization has convinced the modern woman of. One thing I did find a need to account for was the myth of sexual peak. As Team Red laments, and in my post, Myth of the Biological Clock, this feminine-defined delusion is deceptively close to women's post-wall valuation. Since men's SMV generally peaks around 38, Women needed a social convention that would also make their sexual peak coincide with men's. Thus, we read the endless articles about sexual peak inflating older women's sexual prowess above that of the 22-year-old girl children men manifestly prefer for sexual partners. Equalism enforces the delusion that if men are at their most desirable at later stages in life, then so too must be women. Cracks in the wall. For all its efforts to convince women of a feminized redefining of SMV, there are obvious cracks beginning to show in the social constructs designed to ensure a lasting feminine primacy. Since the last wave of significant feminism was carried along by the baby boom generation, women of the consecutive generations are only now beginning to realize the gravity of the have-it-all lie. The institution of gender primacy, masquerading as equalism, is largely and grossly apparent at odds with women's true sexual market valuation and its progression. Try as it may, the feminine imperative has never had an effective counter for the biological motivations that drive SMV. As women age, feminine primacy becomes a victim of its own hypergamy. Thus, the imperative must continually redefine its mission, create new social conventions, and rely on blaming the men it subjugates for its own inadequacies. Women are now realizing their true SMV isn't what feminization has convinced them of too late. One crack in the wall. Another tact is to shame men for their unwillingness to participate in the SMP the feminine imperative defines for and expects them to participate in. Man up, you infantile boys! And another crack appears in the wall. That many a feminist writer can form a prosperous career and celebrity around her inability to come to terms with the conflict between her true SMV and the SMV model the feminine imperative has conditioned into her ego is an indictment of the scope to which the distorted, feminized SMV model has been insaturated into women and our culture. Of love and war. Generally, people of either sex don't like to have love defined for them. The concept of love is loaded with subjectiveness. And not unsurprisingly, you'll offend people's interpretations and sensibilities by trying to contain their idea of love in a defined box. This is one of the reasons love is such a great and human idea. But its ambiguity is also the primary cause of much of the human tragedy and suffering we experience. We see love in religious context, personal interpretations, philosophical essays, biological dynamics, and a whole slew of other arenas, so it's very easy to understand how universally convoluted, manipulative, and yet also how binding and nurturing love can be according to how well or how ill our concepts of love aligns with that of others. In outlining, not defining, a male perspective of love in contrast to a female perspective, it's necessary to understand how a man's understanding of love shifts as he matures. A lot of rational male commenters wanted to find the base root of that concept in their relationship with their mothers. As Freudian as that rings, I wouldn't say it's a bad start. Men do, in fact, learn their first impressions of intimate, physical, and nurturing love from their mothers, and this then forms the foundation of that expected love from their potential wives or lovers. Even as children are unable to think in abstract terms, there is an innate, base understanding of the conditionality that must be met in order to maintain that motherly love. Yo Amy posted a great illustration of this with the still face experiment. Commenter Yo Amy broke this down thusly. That circuit gets printed before we learn to talk, equals before we are able to form abstract and concepts. It's a basic four-piece emotional behavioral circuit. There are many ways that circuit can be imprinted wrong. One is to have the mom or dads on the receiving end, making the kid the giver. Other is having him owning the frame. other is to have the mom or dads respond only when the kid acts out. Other is making the kid act out and then silence him, punish him for it, etc. Shortly, the kid understands the game and starts to play it. And then you build everything on top. Your experiences from ages 12 to 21, of course, help forming you, because you're 35 now and this is a sum accumulative game. But honestly, what happened to you from 12 to 21? Are the same mechanics that were already happening, only adding more external world influence, sex drive, and additional pressures? I'm trying to locate the source of the pain, and is this like a compass or a geometrical piece that wants to find equilibrium? The pain wants to find the good again, from the good, the bad, and the ugly. But it only knows to reach that good by balancing violently between the bad and the ugly and the episodes of rage. And if that doesn't work, splitting or self-mutilation, cutting out the undesired parts of you, your past, identity, emotions, people, relationships, blocking stuff out, etc. It's a constant lookout for the elusive good part of the dynamic. Yo Amy continues, but you weren't confident or self-reassured about your needs and wants because you were still negotiating how to even feel good and safe. So you didn't develop game nor saw girls or relationships for what they were. But you just added this to the previous unresolved mix, like seeking the good, basic, maternal, paternal love where you're defenseless and you're intimately loved and taken care of and safe from girls. Mixing the defenseless and the sexual aggressive drive and the long-time affection longing and the sense of despair of never feeling safe, etc. From the moment we're born, we realize love is conditional, but we want for it to be unconditional. Our idealized state is unconditional love. To be a man is to perform, to excel, to be the one for whom affections are freely given in appreciation and adoration. On a base level, it's this constant striving for that idealized love state that helps us become more than we started as. But it comes at the cost of a misguided belief that a woman is capable of, much less willing to love us as we think is possible. A place to rest. Commenter Peregrine John summed it up. We want to relax. We want to be open and honest. We want to have a safe haven in which struggle has no place, where we gain strength and rest instead of having it pulled from us. We want to stop being on guard all the time and have a chance to simply be with someone who can understand our basic humanity without begrudging it. To stop fighting, to stop playing the game just for a while. We want to, so badly. If we do, we soon are no longer able to. This is a realization that men don't make until they are in a love relationship with a woman. For men, this is, should be, the catalyst for maturing beyond that want for an idealized unconditional love. At that point, they come full circle and understand that the conceptual love they'd hoped they could return to or could be with their mother doesn't exist in the woman he's in love with, and ultimately never really existed between he and his mother from his infancy to adulthood. There is no rest. There is no respite or reprieve from performing. But so strong is the desire for that unconditional love assurance that men thought it prudent to write it into traditional marriage vows, for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, in sickness and in health, to love, cherish, and obey, forsaking all others, until death do you part. In other words, a pledge of unconditional love in spite of all circumstance. These vows are a direct plea for insurances against a female hypergamy that would otherwise be unfettered were it not made in the context of being before God and man. In prior essays, I've mentioned a 65-year-old man whom I used to counsel, whose wife had emotionally blackmailed him for over 20 years. He'd been married once before and divorced from his first wife after 12 years due to not living up to her expectations of financial provisioning. He never made the connection that the women he was in love with had different concepts of what love meant to him. Rather, he evolved his previous concept of love wholesale to match that of women he loved, and thus his idea of love was based upon an endless quest for qualifying for that love. In the first year of his second marriage, he lost his job and was unemployed for about 5 months, leaving his wife as the only revenue source for them. At the end of month 4 of his unemployment, after returning from an interview, he came home to find the locks changed on his home and 2 duffel bags full of his shit were waiting by the door. On top of them was a note written by his second wife which, to the effect, read, "Don't come back until you have a job." I remember him proudly recounting this story to me at the time, because he said, as pissed off as he was at the time, he was grateful for her kicking him in the ass to be a better man. By this point, his concept of love had been completely altered from his almost identical experiences with wife number 1 into a model that was entirely dependent upon his capacity to earn his wife's love. Gone were the idealizations of unconditional love for the sake of love, to be replaced with the tactical, opportunistic concept of female love of his new wife. And he was grateful for it. After 20 years, at 65, now 69, and in failing health, he had come to realize that his efforts to secure her love indefinitely had never been appreciated, only expected. So here he was, facing the very cruel reality that he was losing his health and thus the means to maintain that incessant qualification for her love and affection. The reconciling. I get a lot of email and correspondence about the ruthlessness of my, I guess, seminal War Brides essay. Guys have a hard time accepting the amorality of women's inborn capacity to bond with their own captors as a psychosocially adaptive survival trait, and how this evolved into women's pronounced facility with which they can get over former lovers so much faster than men seem to be capable of. Women don't like me detailing this phenomenon for obvious reasons, but I think men dislike the notion of their easy disposability because of that same inconsistency in gender concepts of love. Even as martyrs, even in death, that unconditional male concept of love is rebuked by women's, by necessity, fluid and utilitarian concept of love. Coming to terms with this is one of the most difficult aspects of taking the red pill. I get that this seems overly nihilistic, but that's the point. All of the very positive, very beneficial aspects of accepting a red pill reality come at the cost of abandoning the blue pill idealisms we've been conditioned to for so long, leaving behind that Pollyanna, expectant, blue pill dream seems like killing an old friend, but unlearning that old paradigm allows you to benefit from a far more hopeful red pill existence. I'm not debating the geniusness or sincerity of women's capacity to love. What I'm positing here is that women's concept of love isn't what men would be led to believe it is. The feminine imperative. The feminine reality. I think one of the basic premises I acknowledge in my essays is one that even some of the more enlightened men of the community don't entirely grasp. This is the presumption of a feminine reality. Sometimes I refer to this as the feminine imperative. Other times I might colloquially express it in terms of it being the matrix for an ease of understanding. But I always presume my readers, even if my comments on other blogs or forums have a basic understanding of this. I think I may be a bit mistaken in this. Everything a man experiences, every social conditioning he receives from the earliest age, every accepted social norm, and every expectation of him to qualify as the definition of a mature adult man in contemporary society is designed to serve a female imperative. Moralists wallow in it. Absolutist and defeated white knights existentially depend upon it. And even the better part of relativists still, often unwittingly, feed and serve the feminine purpose. In fact, so all-encompassing is this reality that we define our masculinity in the terms of how well we can accommodate that feminine influence. Our media celebrates it and brooks no dissent. There is very little dissent, since to peel back the veneer is to be at odds with a reality defined by the female purpose. You feel lonely because you can't understand its influence, and the conditioning you've been subjected to defines the objective solution to curing that feeling. You base the decisions of your future, your education, your career, your religious beliefs, even where you'll choose to live, to better accommodate the feminine influence, either in the present or in the preparation of accommodating it in the future. You get married out of fear for not being found acceptable of it, or from social shame for not yet having accepted your role in service to the imperative. Your children are offered in tribute to it, while in turn you unknowingly perpetuate it in them. You pay tribute in alimony, in divorce proceedings, in the expected sacrifices your career demands to maintain its influence in your own life and in society at large. Men exist to facilitate a feminine reality. We can excuse it with moralism. We can attach notions of honor and stability to it. We can even convince ourselves that the feminine imperative is our own imperative. But regardless, men still serve it. Sexual strategies. For one gender to realize their sexual imperative, the other must sacrifice their own. This is the root source of power the feminine imperative uses to establish its own reality as the normative one. From this flows the rules of engagement for dating or mating, operative social conventions used to maintain cognitive dominance, and laws and legalities that bind society to the benefit of the feminine. From this is derived men's default status as the disposable sex, while women are the protected sex. It's this route that the imperative uses to excuse, not apologize for, the most blatant inconsistencies and atrocities of women. Monogamy and fidelity are only useful when paired with an optimized hypergamy. Without that optimization, they're inconvenient obligations to the feminine reality. In order to affect this reality, men must be convinced themselves of having a degree of more control than the feminine imperative exerts. They must believe it is they who are the masters of a reality defined by the feminine, while remaining dependent upon the systems that the feminine reality outlines for them. So they are told they are kings, brutes, savages, patricians, intellectuals, elites, anything that might convince them that the reality they exist in is privileged and expressly serves their own selfish purpose. Already the protected sex, this all encourages the default presumption of victimhood for the feminine. The crowning irony of the feminine reality is that men should be accused of patriarchy while enabling the very framework of the feminine imperative. The feminine sexual strategy is victorious because even under the contrived auspices of male oppression, it's still the female goal state that is agreed upon as the correct effort. Satisfying the feminine imperative, achieving the ends of pluralistic feminine sexual strategy, is still the normative condition. Men's goals are aberrant. Women's are beatific. Forgive me if I've waxed a bit too poetic here, but it's important to see the matrix for what it really is. The next occasion you lock horns with even the most well-meaning woman's or feminized man's opinions about life, relationships, marriage, having babies, religion, etc., understand that her perceptions are based in this reality. She's correct because her beliefs line up with what the framework of her reality reinforced in her as correct. Any other frame of reference is either utterly alien to her at best, wicked and evil at worst. Femcentrism. My intent with all this is to illustrate how the reality in which we find things normal is rendered by femcentric influence across ethnicities and encompassing all manner of social diversity. This influence is so insaturated into culture, laws, media, entertainment, from our collective social consciousness to our individual psyches, that we simply take it for granted as the operative framework in which we live. I realize this is a tough pill to swallow, because the male imperative does in fact intersect with the female imperative depending on mutual goals. However, the point is that the operative framework, the reality we function in, is primarily defined by the feminine. I can remember first becoming aware of just the hints of this the first time I watched a popular sitcom on TV with a critical eye. There were simply no positively masculine actors or roles on any show, and rather, every male was ridiculed for his masculinity. This then led into other aspects of society and media I was just starting to become aware of. The allegory of taking the red pill is one of an awakening. Feminization was everywhere, but my inner, conditioned guilt for even considering the possibility of feminine primacy was hindering my unplugging from it. I remember at first feeling guilty about feeling offended by just my noticing this. I felt ashamed of myself for thinking that maybe things weren't as normal as women would like me to think. What I didn't understand was that this was part of my conditioning, to internalize a sense of shame for questioning that normalcy. A lot of men never get past this programming and never unplug. It's just too embedded in who we are. And the resulting internal conflict will prompt them to deny the realities of their condition and sometimes actively fight others who challenge the normalcy they need in order to exist. Once I'd gotten past the self-shame, I began to notice other patterns and interlocking social conventions that promoted this femcentrism. From the macro dynamics of divorce laws and legal definitions of rape, to the gender bias in military conscription, drafting only men to die in war, and down to the smallest details of mundane water cooler talk in the workplace, I began to realize just how overwhelming this influence is on our existences. Observing the framework. Recently, I listened to an advice radio talk show where a woman called in emotional distress with her husband's actions. Apparently, she dated the man for a year or two before marriage, and they talked about how neither wanted children from the outset. Prior to the marriage, both agreed, no kids. That is, until about a year into their marriage, the wife had secretly gone off the pill and had made deliberate efforts in her sexual activities with her husband in order to conceive. Trouble was, she wasn't getting pregnant. Only later did the man confess that he'd had a vasectomy so as not to risk having kids with any woman he paired up with. The ensuing indignation wasn't directed at the woman's admitted duplicity and covert efforts to deceive her husband into thinking she'd had an accidental pregnancy, but rather all the fires of hell were concentrated on this man's alleged deception of her. This serves as a prime example of how the feminine reality frames the directions of our lives. Publicly and privately, not even an afterthought was spared for the woman's motivation and desperate measures to achieve her sexual imperative, because the feminine imperative is normalized as the correct goal of any conflict. A woman's existential imperative, her happiness, her contentment, her protection, her provisioning, her empowerment, literally anything that benefits the feminine, is not only encouraged socially, but in most cases, mandated by law. Ironically, most doctors require a wife's written consent to perform a vasectomy on a married man, not because of a legal mandate, but rather to avoid legal retaliations and damages from a man's wife. By hook or by crook, her imperative is the correct one. Some will argue that it hasn't always been thus, and that in certain eras, women have been reduced to property like cattle. While that may have some merit, I would argue that the perpetuation of this notion better serves the new feminine reality in promoting a need for recognition of victim status and thus a need for restitution. The truth is that even the most ardent supporters of reconciling a patriarchal past are still operating in the feminine reality in the now. Other than sultans and emperors, very few men born prior to the Dark Ages have ever really owned a woman.
Chapter 10, Continued, Part 3,
Sexual Revolution. I got into a hypothetical debate with an online friend as to what it would mean to humanity, and masculinity in particular, if a new method of birth control was developed with the specific and unique ability to allow men to control conception to the same degree women were given with hormonal contraception in the mid-60s. I thought it interesting that human effort could create reliable contraception for women in the 60s, yet in 2013, we can map the human genome and yet not figure out how to afford men the same degree of birth control. Put simply, the feminine imperative will not allow this. Imagine the social and economic damage to the feminine infrastructure if Prometheus gave such fire to men. Imagine the balance of control veering back into the masculine. For men to literally have the exclusive choice to fulfill a woman's sexual strategy or not. The conversation got heated. Men could never be trusted with such a power. Surely humanity would come to a grinding, apocalyptic end if the feminine sexual strategy was thwarted by reliable male contraception. Societies would be sundered, population would nosedive, and the nuclear family would be replaced with a neo-tribalism dictated by men's sexual strategies. Honestly, you'd think the discovery of atomic weapons was on par with such an invention. The ridiculous, pathetic, endemically juvenile and perverse masculinity that 50 years of systematic feminization created could never be trusted to further humanity in pursuing their sex's inborn imperatives. Yet, this is precisely the power that was put into the hands of women in the 1960s and remains today. The threat that male contraception represents to the feminine imperative is one of controlling the framework of which gender's sexual strategy will be the normative. Prior to the advent of unilaterally female-exclusive hormonal birth control and the sexual revolution that resulted from it, the gender playing field was level, if not tipped in favor of masculinity due to men's provisioning being a motivating factor in women achieving their own gender imperative. Latex prophylactics were available in the 40s, and this may have afforded men a slight advantage. But both parties knew and agreed to the terms of their sexual activity at the time of copulation. Once feminine exclusive birth control was convenient and available, the locus of control switched to feminine primacy. Her imperative became the normalized imperative. His sexual imperative was only a means to achieving her own, and now the control was firmly placed in favor of feminine hypergamy. Whether in the developing world or in first world nations, the onus of directing the course of humanity fell upon women, and thus the feminine reality evolved into what it is today. The feminine mystique. Perhaps the single most useful tool women have possessed for centuries is their unknowability. I made that word up, but it's applicable. Women of all generations, for hundreds of years, have cultivated the sense of being unknowable, random, or in worst case, fickle or ambiguous. This is the feminine mystique, and it goes hand in hand with the feminine prerogative. A woman always reserves the right to change her mind, and the mythical feminine intuition. A woman just knows. While a man can never be respected for anything less than being forthright and resolute, say what you mean what you say, women are rewarded and reinforced by society for being elusive and, dare I say, seemingly irrational. In fact, if done with the right art, it's exactly this elusiveness that makes her both desirable and intolerably frustrating. However, to pull this off, she must be, or seem to be, unknowable, and encourage all of male society to believe so. The feminine mystique appeals to the feminine psyche for the same reasons chick crack worked so well in PUA technique. It appeals to the same secret power dynamic that makes metaphysical association so attractive, religion, superstition, intuition, etc. One need look no further than women's innate love of gossip to understand. There's power in secrets for women. It's hardly a surprise that connections with witchcraft have been associated with the feminine for so long. In a historically male-dominated culture, it follows that the power of secrecy and mysticism would need to be cultivated into the feminine as a resource for influencing the men in control of it. Sometimes that may have ended with a woman burned at the stake, but more often it was a means to becoming the power behind the throne by order of degrees and depending upon the status of the man she could enchant. Combine that mysticism with sexuality and you've got the true feminine mystique. The most useful tool the feminine imperative possesses in its quest for optimal hypergamy. The feminine mystique permeates intergender communication. On every forum response, on every blog comment, on every Facebook post, and in any article ever written by women with a personal, feminine investment in the subject, there is a residue of recognizing the feminine mystique. When a woman retorts to an observation of female behavior that betrays female intent, the standard misdirection is always saturated in the unknowable, unpredictably capricious, feminine mystique. The first and second rule of Fight Club for the feminine imperative is to protect the mystery of the female, and the sisterhood has no mercy for those who would betray that. The closer you get to the truth, the louder women screech. 4 years, I've striven to break down confusion and common problems by observing behavior. Women are human beings with the same basic motivations that men are subject to, with some greater or lesser variation in their reasoning and methodologies. The point being is that women are every bit as subject to being as mundane or as extraordinary as men are. But the difference is that men don't enjoy a masculine mystique. With rare exceptions, we don't generally cultivate this sense of mystery because we're not rewarded for it to the degree women are. And honestly, we haven't needed to. But for a woman, if she can cultivate this mystique, her attentions become a reward unto themselves for the guy who is lucky enough to tame her. Rest assured, when you think a woman is crazy, she's crazy like a fox. She's crazy with a reason. Women are every bit as calculating as men. In fact, more so, I'd argue, because they have the mystique to hide a multitude of sins behind. They're not irrational. They're calculated. You just have to develop an ability to read a woman's actions and behaviors and see the latent purpose behind them. In contemporary times, men are far too ready to write off women as irrational agents. Even Freud was fooled by the hysterics of women's responses and wrote them off as largely incapable, random, and duplicitous to their own interest. I can't begin to tell you how frustrating it is to hear an elderly man say, "Women, I guess we'll never really understand them, huh?" adding a nervous laugh. How many times have you been asked by a friend, "So, did you get lucky with Christy last night?" We don't think much of this passing question, but it's framed in such a way that men autonomously perpetuate the myth of this mystique. It's not luck that gets you laid. I understand that circumstance, and being the right guy at the right time most certainly plays a part, but that's not the operative here. However, if due to our preconditioning, we feel as though we got lucky, we won the lottery, or walked away with a rare and valuable prize, it doesn't help us to understand what it is we did correctly in a given instance. It perpetuates women as the mysterious prize givers and ensures they maintain an indirect primary power role in embodying the prize that is feared to be lost. You were lucky to have gotten sex with this mysterious woman, so it must be something rare and valuable indeed. The feminine mystique discourages questioning the process or the motives involved in intergender relations. Men are just happy to have had the chance of experiencing the unknowable woman they scarcely understand. When mixed with sexual deprivation, the lucky fate element makes the sex that much more absorbing. It's this luck precognition for men, fostered by women, that leads to the scarcity mentality and often, but not exclusively, one-itis in men. It serves the feminine if men willingly adopt the feminine mystique mindset with regards to their intimacy. Sexuality is a woman's first, best agency, and any social mechanism that contributes to the value of it will always be encouraged. The Wall. Throughout this book thus far, I've made references to the wall, the point at which women lose their competitive edge in the SMP, sexual marketplace, to younger rivals. The following was contributed by a rational male commenter, S. Her comment regarding the wall made me aware that I hadn't yet gone into much detail regarding the wall and its socio-psychological effects upon women. Yet, it's a term I have seen before arriving at this blog, but have never heard in reality. I always attributed it to a woman losing her looks, but to place it at exactly 30 seems to me to be too precise a calculation, as there are many variables to be taken into consideration, I would imagine. For example, a party girl, serial tanner, and smoker could probably lose her looks long before she reaches 30, whereas a clean-living, late bloomer might not even realize her potential until her mid to late 20s. I've seen women from my school, the most popular girls with guys, change the most in a negative manner, and the nerds or just the most unexpected girls have become more attractive over the years. It's freaking odd. Technically, the wall was a sports term used for athletes who had reached an age where they lost their competitive edge. The infamous wall a woman reaches, or slams into, as the case may be, is somewhat of an ambiguous term that was actually coined by catty women long before the manosphere came into existence. It used to be a relatively less combative term that women used for one another in an effort to disqualify an intrasexual competitor. A woman implying another woman had hit the wall was marginally more polite than calling her an old slut. But the latent purpose is still the same: disqualifying a sexual competitor from men's mating considerations. The fear of decay. Underneath the obvious utility of the wall as an epithet is a more painful truth: the inevitable decay of women's sexual appeal. Their first, and foremost, only, real agency of power they've ever actualized over men to ensure their long-term security needs. In the heyday of second-wave feminism, the sisterhood's message was all about collective empowerment and solidarity, but beneath that was the intrinsic hypergamic need to compete for the best mate their looks and sexual availability could attract. As I've written before, women prefer their combat in the psychological, and there are few fears women harbor as deep and as long as losing their sexual agency with men. They know the wall will eventually come, and they don't like to be reminded of it. Women's intrasexual combative use of the knowledge and fear of the wall did not go unnoticed by men. Therefore, the feminine imperative found it necessary to make the truth about the wall as socially and individually subjective as possible. As with most uncomfortable truths unique to women's weaknesses, the feminine creates social conventions and ambiguities to misdirect men from becoming aware of women's eventual powerlessness over them, i.e., the progressive loss of her sexual agency. The threat of having men become aware of women's Achilles heel before they could consolidate long-term commitment with their best hypergamic option was too great a risk not to form social conventions about the wall. Implications of the wall. Thus, an intergender social context, the wall became individualized and subjective for women. And it's within this framework that women like commenter S are most comfortable in addressing the reality of the wall. Not all women are like that. Nawalt, or N-A-W-A-L-T, the go-to mantra of feminized subjectivity, is a direct result of subjectivizing the inevitability of the wall. In fact, virtually every operative social convention women rely upon for empowerment and self-esteem finds its root purpose in avoiding the fear of the wall. The myth of sexual peak. The myth of the biological clock. The social convention that women are just as sexual as men are all very complex social rationales with the latent purpose of convincing the majority of men and women alike that post-wall women can still be equally effective sexual competitors with pre-wall women. It's important to bear in mind that all of these complex social conventions are rooted in a fear of the wall. I'm repeating this point to emphasize the importance this has in a feminized society that's subjected to feminine hypergamy as its most operative doctrine. When enough women, through cultural forces or personal circumstance, can't capitalize upon what they think is their due, optimal hypergamic male option, then society must be acculturated to believe that women past their wall expiration date can and should be as desirable as those in their prime. Think of it as a retroactive social moving of the feminized goalpost. This is the gravity and extent that the fear of the wall plays for women. Feminized society is literally structured around avoiding it. Defining the wall. When I wrote Navigating the SMP, Sexual Marketplace, the reason I use 30 as the general age women typically hit the wall is really a combination of factors. Most importantly, it represents the threshold at which most women realize their lessened capacity to sexually compete with the next generation of women in their actualized sexual peak, 22 to 24. However, there is a male part of the wall equation that needs to be understood. 30 is also the general age at which men should become aware of their own, longer-lasting sexual market value and potential. This affects women's interpretations of the wall. Once a man is aware that he has the capacity to attract the sexual attentions of the younger women he'd previously had limited access to and understanding of, his actions and imperatives then begin to define the wall for women who are approaching that threshold. And unsurprisingly, this is the point at which wall-fearing women begin their accusations of men's infantile ego issues, shaming, etc., for preferring younger women than themselves. When we, and as women in particular would have us, view the wall in terms of just physical attractiveness, we don't see the full picture and relevancy the wall has for women. Is just as much a psychological issue as it is a physical one. It's very easy and often fun to compare pictures of girls we knew in high school with their current Facebook profile shots at 40 plus years old and get a laugh at how bad she hit the wall. It's also easy for women to point out the notable exceptions to the rule and find a hot 38-year-old woman with three kids competing in the Miss Fitness USA pageant. It gives them a sense of hope about their own decay. However, the wall is much more than just the physical. It's the conditional that accelerates or decelerates a woman's date with the wall. Single mother, acceleration. Consistent bad personal habits, acceleration. Careerist obsessive, acceleration. Obesity, acceleration. Do notable exceptions to these exist? Of course, but they prove the rule. And that rule comes in the form of such an overwhelming fear that contemporary society needed to be restructured to help avoid it. The 38-year-old careerist, single mother of three, competing in fitness pageants, is only a hero because of the fear of the wall. The threat. Nothing is more threatening yet simultaneously attractive to a woman than a man who is aware of his own value to women. My use of the word threat here isn't to imply malice. I'm sure more simplistic associations with violence or conflict is the natural one, but threat is a challenge. How one deals with it is what's at issue. As I stated in Wait for It, women's sexual strategy is very schizophrenic. Ideally, women want a man that other women want to fuck. But in order to assess his sexual market value to other women, he's got to have exercisable options for her to compete against, or at least display indirect social proof to that effect. So, she needs to limit his options while simultaneously determining he has those options. This internal conflict between a want for security and provisioning and a need for the Gina tingles that only the excitement, indignation, drama, and alpha dominance can stimulate is the fundamental root for women's shit test. From Plate Theory 6. Essentially, a shit test is used by women to determine one or a combination of these factors. A. Confidence, first and foremost. B. Options. Is this guy really into me because I'm special, or am I his only option? C. Security. Is this guy capable of providing me with long-term security? Women's shit testing is a psychologically evolved, hardwired survival mechanism. Women will shit test men as autonomously and subconsciously as men will stare at a woman's big boobs. They cannot help it. And often enough, just like men staring at a nice rack or a great ass, even when they're aware of doing it, they'll still do it. Men want to verify sexual availability to the same degree women want to verify a masculine dominance or confidence. For a woman to encounter a man with a healthy awareness of his own value to women, this constitutes a threat. Here is a man for whose attention women will demonstrably compete for, and he knows this. This is the most basic affront to the feminine imperative. To be unplugged and of high sexual market value and to derive a sense of confidence from being consciously aware of it. Therefore, in order to promote and actualize her own sexual strategy, his self-confidence must be challenged with self-doubt. Because if such a man were to use this knowledge to his own benefit, he may not select her from a pool of better prospective women. Thus, in various ways, both consciously and subconsciously, she must ask him, "Are you really sure of yourself? You think you're so great? Maybe you're just egotist." Don't tempt fate. In this example, we can see the conflict inherent in women's sexual strategy. She wants the alpha dominance of a confident man, but not so confident that he can exercise his options with other women well enough to make an accurate estimation of her own SMV, sexual market value. Ambiguity in men's assessment of a woman's true sexual market value is the primary tool of the feminine imperative. The same characteristics that give him his confidence and acknowledged sense of worth are exactly the same things that women want to be associated with. Even the most controlling, domineering wife still wants to tell her